Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Very well.
I would like to discuss an article that we had in one of the newspapers here recently, the Star Ledger, about an incident that happened. And I qualify this as stupid news, even news that most people don't think.
We have lots of that in New Jersey. We have lots of stupid news in New Jersey.
Well, this would be filed under news that maybe people don't realize is stupid, but if you think about it, it really is. You ready for this? Here's the headline. Manasquan man, Manasquan's a town here in Jersey, Manasquan man faces $1,000 in fines for allegedly killing a goose with a pellet gun.
I actually saw that.
A Manasquan man faces at least $1,000 in fine after being cited for killing a goose that fouled the deck of his waterfront home, authorities said today. David Martins, 65, was charged Monday night by the Monmouth County SPCA with one count of needlessly killing a living creature, said Victor Amato, chief animal cruelty officer for the agency. What's the problem with that, Mark?
It's a goose, and we eat them.
Yeah, yeah. So if he had eaten it, would it have been needlessly killing it?
I guess not.
I guess if you make soup, it's okay.
Can I tell you what the problem with that is, and maybe has said something about New Jersey? We're citing him for needlessly killing a goose, but we're not citing him for shooting a gun.
Yeah. Well, it was a pellet gun, though. I think they're not illegal. Well, no, isn't that crazy? So hold on. He could get into his car and drive to the supermarket and buy a dead goose. He could go goose hunting.
He can go goose hunting.
But he can't kill the goose. Now, if you're not from the state, we have a population of resident geese that are in New Jersey
that's problematic.
Oh, it's completely
matter
problematic.
Matter of fact, I don't know if you know this. I read an article just recently about around the airport, around Newark Airport, and JFK, I think, as well. They're going to be culling geese because they're such a problem for the airplanes.
Does the Manasquan SPCA know about this?
But seriously, that's something that's going to have to happen because they're dangerous. They're presenting a danger.
Yeah, there was
to the
something
airports.
About a jumbo jet landing in the Hudson River because of
exactly.
some geese recently.
Exactly.
I don't know.
So
in
order to make sure that doesn't happen again,
Sully Sulberger was cited by the Manasquan SPCA for the geese that were killed, and
that was very funny.
Save the people, kill the geese. Look, it's stupid. Okay,
it's just backwards. It's just people aren't thinking.
They're not cartoon characters. They're not animals. They don't have homes they go to.
They are animals.
I'm sorry, they are animals.
They're not
like
people.
Cartoon animals. They don't have homes they go to. They don't really live in the fairy tales. They're geese, okay? And the resident population of non-hibernating geese that is in New Jersey is really causing a problem. It's really fouling waterways.
And realize that Francis and I also, we're not saying, you know, oh, okay, allow dog fighting, allow cruelty to animals, Francis and I are the first ones to stand in line and say, you know what, the battery cages at these chicken factories is a huge problem and we can't treat the animals this way. Okay. We're the first people to stand in line to defend assail those actions. But at the same time, if geese are causing a problem for airplanes, Or
the ability to play. Now, here's the thing. Geese turds, for lack of a better word, are quite large and quite disgusting. And when you have a resident population of geese on a lawn, you wouldn't let your kids go out and play on that lawn if they're there all the time. That's how bad they are. This isn't like a little something. So, look, I understand if you want to say, listen, you can't discharge a firearm in town. You can't, if that's hunting, you can't hunt without a license. But the idea of needlessly killing a living creature in a community where we have supermarkets full of beef and butcher shops everywhere, it shows such a disconnect that we have with where our food comes from. chicken that you eat is made of a chicken that once walked around somewhere.
Francis and I talk about this all the time. We're so disconnected from the food now that people just don't realize that your chicken breast came from a chicken. It's not grown by, you know, in some factory somewhere. Well, it is grown in a factory, but it's not grown in some petri dish somewhere and never was living or breathing. It's chicken.
Let me read a little more from the Star Ledger article. Neighbors heard the shots and called police. Amato said that after interviewing Martins and his neighbors, Manasquan patrolman Brian Gillespie confiscated the pellet gun and the ammunition. That's a good use of police resources, right? This is my favorite.
Isn't the ammunition for a pellet gun pellets. Ball bearings?
No, sort of.
Isn't that?
The dead bird was taken to the Red Bank Veterinary Hospital where it underwent tests, including x-rays, to confirm the cause of death. You needed x-rays? It had pellets in it. That would have been enough for me. He said the pellets in the bird matched Martin's ammunition. And here's a quote from the SPCA officer. I can understand he's got a problem, but this was the wrong way to go about taking care of it. Why in the world was it the wrong way to go about taking care of it? I mean, again, if it's not legal to discharge a gun and a pellet gun, but remember, a pellet gun's an air gun, no gunpowder, you know.
He's not torturing the animal. He's not, you know, he did nothing that a goose hunter wouldn't do out in
goose hunter land?
In goose hand hunter land. Goose hunter land, I believe that's.
No, but you know what? Mark and I have advocated for a long time. When these birds really do become a problem in parks, they'll come in and they'll do some culling of the birds. And what they do is they gather all the birds together, and you know, PETA and those people have these films of these despicable practices where they take the birds and they gas them. They gather the birds together, they put them in a truck, and they gas them. And then they throw them out. What the hell is wrong with you?
It's the craziest thing that I've ever
heard. Why don't we just have, you know, if they're in populated areas and you don't allow a hunt, a general hunt, send those officers who are getting the birds, chop their necks off, chop their heads off with their necks, just like you
and
did for...
send them to the food shelter.
Do you remember A Christmas Carol, Tiny Tim, the big goose in the window, Christmas time?
We've been eating geese for a really long time.
And, you know, there are hungry people around.
So why are we
throwing away meat?
I don't understand.
I can't sit for the life of me. Anyway, you know, we should probably start a fund to pay Mr. Martin's fine. Anyway, Dave Martins, you didn't do anything wrong as far as I'm concerned. We're going to come back in just a couple of minutes, and we'll be talking with Gail Green, author, one of the most important restaurant critics in the world, and a now television personality on the newest iteration of Top Chef Masters. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. And our guest today, joining us again, we're very excited, is one of our favorite food critics and now food judges, Gail Green, is joining us today.
Gail, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. A lot has happened since last time we talked.
Yeah, indeed it has. And we get to see you on television now. I have to say, I've spent so many years wondering what Gail Green looked like behind that hat, and now I get to see your face all the time.
Yeah, I was very upset about that because I had thought I was going to be a judge on Top Chef with my hat and it would be covering my eyes. And they said, no, there's no way you can communicate with the public and have them trust you and come to care about you if they can't see your eyes. And I said, well, I've been doing it now for 40 years. I've been doing TV with a hat on, but they persuaded me. So I really wanted to be a judge on that show. I thought it would be fun.
Well, I guess it's time to embark on your new career in television, huh?
Right.
Well, now we should fill in our listening audience for anyone who's been living under a rock. Gail Green is one of the judges on the new show, not Top Chef, but Top Chef Masters, which is the reality show. We all know that Top Chef is one of our favorite, and actually one of the only TV reality shows that Mark and I really enjoyed. Top Chef Masters is the same concept, however, it's with established chefs, prominent chefs, who are competing not for personal gain, but for $100,000 to be donated to their charity of choice. And you have some amazing chefs on there. This is like the graduate school of Top Chef, Gail, isn't it?
Right, and I think that a lot of chefs who normally would say, I don't need to be made a fool of, or I don't need to be seen not quite making the deadline, did it because they cared so much about their charity.
You know, one of the things that strikes me about this show that is that really is driven home, and I think that people outside the food world don't realize what a food community is across the country, because as these great chefs from all over the country, in many different disciplines, many different cuisines, one guy was the basically the chef for the French Culinary Institute, as they all walk onto the set, they're like, oh, hey, Rick, how's it going? You know, they all know each other. This is a community of colleagues, isn't it?
Well, you know, of course, that is something relatively recent, because there was a time when people didn't even know who the chefs were in the kitchen. And now the chefs have come out of their kitchen and started doing many charity benefits. They get to know each other, and they get to know chefs from around the country. So there's a great camaraderie. It's quite wonderful.
Can I tell you about that camaraderie? One of the things that's very warming to the soul is it's the exact opposite of Hell's Kitchen, which I despise. And I'm not talking about Gordon Ramsay in particular, but what he does on that show
is the worst of what TV and is the worst of what reality
and
TV
is the,
are
and
all,
it,
all for us.
And is the worst of what kitchens used to be, and the collegiality and professionalism and, you know, the love of food and the respect for each other that people show on Top Chef Masters. That's the model that I hope that young culinarians follow, is what's going on in the show you're on. Would you agree with that, Gail?
Well, you know, probably the audience enjoys seeing young people who are on the rise competing with each other and tripping each other up and, you know, sabotaging each other. I think there's a lot of, it's one of the reasons that Top Chef's so popular is they love watching that.
Mm-hmm.
And on this show, I think it's quite amazing the camaraderie, how they help each other. If one of the chefs isn't getting his plate ready on time, the other chefs all pitch in to help him meet the deadline. You would never see that normally on The Apprentice or
Hell's Kitchen, certainly.
Normal regular Top Chef show, which people love.
Right.
Well, one of the things that I think that maybe doesn't get noticed as well here, and again, this is for charity, the chefs are taking where the lesser known chefs are fighting for notoriety. These established chefs are more that they need. They have much more to lose. If they flub something here and embarrass themselves, they've already got established restaurants and established careers, and so there's a lot more on the negative side here that can happen to them. So you know that they're doing this for the right reasons.
Well, I think that one of the things that we thought about a lot when we realized we're getting these really top chefs or those who have many restaurants was how few of them are ever actually at a stove anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, there they are, faced with turning out, let's say, a dinner for 100,
mm-hmm.
miniature dinner for 100, with no help. Normally, there's a kitchen to back them up.
Right.
So it's even more of a gamble for them when they come on the show. And suddenly, like in the last week show, where they all had to shop, and a couple of them hadn't been in a supermarket
Mm-hmm. Hey, listen, Gail, even in our own restaurants, I get behind the bar once in a while, and I'm like, hey.
I used to be faster.
This isn't quite as easy as it used to be. What's going on?
I was struck, though, by the one challenge where the chefs had to go and the four contestants had to go and shop for each other. Each chef bought a box of food that they presented to the other chef. And, you know, on some of the reality shows, you might have people looking to buy very difficult things to really challenge everybody. And what was really was great, I was wondering how that was going to turn out, but all of these guys, when shopping for the other chef, said, well, you know, I know he really likes seafood, so I'm going to get, and they gave each other great boxes of food to help each other shine. And I thought, wow, this is really great, and that's what being in a restaurant should be all about.
Yeah, I think that's typical of the kind of thinking that those chefs have, the respect for each other. They actually went out to find things that they knew that they would be happy cooking themselves, or that they thought the chef they were shopping for would be delighted. I think the only one that got thrown a curve was the chef, the seafood chef, who got meat.
Yeah, he got no fish. He got no fish. That was, but he still got a good box of food. He didn't get, you know.
Right, it was food that would work.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we come back on the other side. We're going to talk more with Gail Green about Top Chef Masters and also about what's going on in her life as one of the top food critics in the United States. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome, but it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo, for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional, and that can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're speaking with Gail Green. She is a noted restaurant critic, one of the most important restaurant critics in America. She's got a stint on Top Chef Masters as one of the judges. Now, Gail, when did you start reviewing for New York Magazine? What year was that?
1968.
And you fast became one of the most important and one of the most enduring restaurant critics in America. And you reviewed at New York Magazine until recently, but you've left New York Magazine, but now you're back in print. You're with Crain's New York Business, right?
Well, yes. Crain's decided that they would like to syndicate my blog from my website. So every week when I put up Bite on insatiablecritic.com, they decide whether that's the one they're going to use. They edit it to fit their space. And I then have to choose whether I want to give it three hats, two hats, or one hat.
that's great. The hats.
The hats are all about what I want to go back. It's not really a review in the sense that I could give stars. I never was able to give stars, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I always avoided it. But I thought hats indicating how desperately I want to go back or how reluctant I am to go back. Would be useful to the reader.
Well, you know, you invited us many years ago. We had the great pleasure of dining with you. You invited us to go to Sfolia back when they first opened, and you scooped them, and you showed them to us, and then you shared it with all of New York, and we had a wonderful dish at Sfolia, which was their strawberries, fresh in-season strawberries with balsamic vinegar on spaghetti and with tomatoes and balsamic vinegar and fresh strawberries. It was delicious. We stole it, of course, and do it every strawberry season, and we're eternally grateful to you. But we steal it with credit. We tell people where it's from.
Oh, great.
But I went just last night. I was at Civetta, which is their downtown place from the same folks that own Sfolia. And it's remarkable. Have you been?
Well, I haven't been. We can't tell anybody, but I'm going tonight.
Well, fortunately.
Recently, I took to tweeting.
Uh-huh.
First, I thought it was Twittering, but it turns out it's tweeting. So I can't, when people say, well, I'm going to do this now, or I'm just leaving to go to the such and such a restaurant, I can't do that because I don't want people to know where I'm eating that night.
Well, you know, can I tell you a funny story? I have a friend who's a wine director in an Upper East Side restaurant that shall remain nameless, and Frank Bruni was in the restaurant, the critic for the New York Times was in the restaurant, and he was tweeting under the table. And he tweeted that he thought the chair was somewhat uncomfortable. Of course, there were people in the restaurant who follow him on Twitter. And about 4 minutes after he tweeted that, someone showed up with a new chair for him. And he was a little surprised.
Well, I can't imagine tweeting at the table. It's so rude.
I do think it's kind of rude, isn't it?
You know,
yeah, somebody took a phone call. No, I guess it's they... texting.
Yeah.
They think that texting is not rude because it's not a telephone call.
I disagree.
I think I'm just an old soul, but you know, I have a 12-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son and some other small children. And one of the things that it's just acceptable, and obviously it's not acceptable with my kids in my house and when we go out to dinner, but it's an acceptance of you don't have my complete attention, and I think that's really a shame. I'm a little bit of old school that way, and if you're out to dinner with me, I want your 100% attention, and you'll have mine.
Oh, I agree. I remember once we got up in a very dark restaurant. I think it was the Macau Trading Company, standing at the entrance about to leave, and I looked around, and under every table there was a little glowing light.
Yeah, you know, it's a shame. I went out with...
It isn't sexy.
No.
Isn't
it the least sexy, romantic thing you can do?
I tell you that it really, and I will become, if it's a social event, I will not have dinner with you. I will get up from the table. And if it's someone like I have, you know, nieces and nephews, and they know that it is not, I went out to the Star Tavern with my sister and my niece, just a simple pizza joint. And, you know, it is acceptable among a certain generation. I'm just going to be an old fart when it comes to that, because my niece picked up the phone and I said, listen, you can sit at a different table.
I know it's inevitable. We're going to be having our cell phones or our blueberries or whatever we use, they're going to be internally fixed in our bodies.
I'm sure that you're right.
You don't have an option of not responding.
And I'm glad I was born no later than I was, because I don't really want to see this. But I said to my niece, who's, you know, in her 20s, and she was not being rude by the standard of her generation. I said, listen, you can continue to have a text conversation, but you will be paying for your own pizza and sitting at this table alone, because I will not sit here while you text someone else who I'm not enough conversation for you, you know?
Francis and I talk about this a lot. I really believe that people are missing something. When you're going off and your attention is not 100% on the things that are happening in a restaurant or at a party or whatever you're doing, when people don't give their full attention to an event or being social or talking to the people they're actually with.
You know, in the very early days of everyone carrying a cell phone, there were restaurants that had little booths that required you to go into the booth if you were going to talk on your cell phone. Imagine if you required someone to, go into a booth and if they want to text.
Yes. I think if anyone's going to do it, it's going to be Sasha Petrasky down from Milk and Honey. It's going to be one of his rules. You have to check your cell phone at the door.
But you wouldn't dare, right, as a restaurateur? You wouldn't dare require people.
No, never. Not possible. We do have a no.
I guess things are hard enough in the restaurant business right at this moment.
Well, you know, it's funny. We do have a no cell phone policy in the dining room, which we enforce if your cell phone use becomes intrusive to another diner. But at table 51, if I have four people who are being incredibly rude to each other by just texting, well, I can't go to the table and say, could you just stop being jerks to each other? You know, if you want to be a jerk to your guests, I guess you're allowed to do that. You know, it's not my business. But it's incredibly uncouth. Don't you find, Gail?
I think you could probably put a fly in each soup and say, I'm not going to really notice anyway.
Oh, Lord. Well, now,
actually, you know what? I remember how chefs used to paint plates? Chefs were very into the squeeze bottle painting or whatever. They would paint plates a lot.
Oh, right.
I think maybe we should paint stop texting into the middle of their soup.
So, do you remember the name, chef's name, John Sedler?
No.
John Sedler was like a pioneer in a minimalist of painting on the plate and minimalist and odd combinations of food. He just opened a restaurant downtown L.A. called Riviera.
Mm-hmm.
And on the plate, he has things painted like danger for spicy dish.
That's wonderful.
And that's actually more important than the food, which unfortunately is not really.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. So let me ask you, Gail, you've been at the had your foot on the neck of the New York restaurant scene for a long time. What other sort of conventions have you seen sort of fall away or come to the fore that you think are sort of unfortunate? Because dining really was much more formal in the 60s and 70s at fine restaurants, and now it's not. What's changed on the social landscape in restaurants?
Well, I don't mind that we don't have to wear little white gloves and men don't have to wear ties in most restaurants anymore. But I think there should always be some special restaurants where you really do feel it's such a unique place that it's worth dressing up. I think one of the things that's happened is how noisy restaurants have become, and I can't find adjectives to describe how painful it is. Each one, in fact, today in the New York Times, Frank Bruni has reviewed Table 8,
mm-hmm.
and he is so unhappy with the painful noise that the whole restaurant, I think it got a satisfactory.
Yeah, I got a satisfactory
and
today.
And I think maybe the last five or six restaurants I've been in, I just would want to send them material on how to find inexpensive soundproofing.
Well, you know, it's funny, but not only is there a level of volume that's acceptable, you know, that sort of ambient noise that has really grown, but there is also a school of restaurants that I have not been able to figure out, which play very loud music during dinner, and music that is not sort of designed to aid the digestion, and I always think, well, these guys must make a lot of money on 27-year-old wealthy bankers, because who over 30 wants to listen to this music while you eat dinner? Do you find that as well?
Well, I think that they believe that people under 30 love it. And I think that, you know, a lot of restaurants, they don't get complaints. They just have young people looking great, screaming to be heard over the noise and the music.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I'm sitting at a dinner table, I really feel stupid when I'm shouting to talk to my companion across the table. It's just ungracious somehow.
Well, we all hate it. But I don't know if it's because we're over 30.
I think that has something to do with it.
It's definitely built in, and they think it has to do with giving the place more energy,
mm-hmm.
and that people, young people, will demand it. There's a restaurant that dares not to have music, like Corton,
mm-hmm.
Dares to not have music, and it has this wonderful serenity.
Yeah,
but it has a buzz of people eating and the room being full.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. which is pleasant, and you want that.
I miss hearing the clanking of the fork on the plate when I'm at dinner.
Now, we're talking about, you know, where restaurants are with regard to history. You have you're very contemporary in that you have a pretty important website, insatiablecritic.com, where there is it's very current, but you also have a tremendous collection of restaurant reviews from history that really give you it's amazing to look back at reviews from 20 or 30 years ago to see the difference and the change in our perspective. And if anyone's wondering how Americans have progressed as far as food sophistication, take a look at your stuff.
My vintage archive on the insatiablecritic.com goes back to 1965. One of my first article about food, about the reopening of La Côte Basque by a great restaurateur called Henri Soulet. And it always occurred to me that all those old reviews from New York Magazine starting in 1968, when New York Magazine began, people might like to see how it was and how we were traumatized by this snobism of the French restaurants that were the most important restaurants at that moment. Watching the evolution of the moment when Chinese restaurants were the best that they have ever been and have never been that wonderful again.
What era was that?
I've been transcribing all these old articles, some of my favorites, and I must say I'm amazed how much space the magazine gave to food, and sometimes I can't believe some of the sentences that I made up. I'm kind of getting a kick out of rereading them myself.
When was the Chinese restaurant ascendant?
I'm just at the moment transcribing that piece. It's called The Scrutable Chinese Handbook. It was a huge collection of all about whether food was better in Midtown or in Chinatown, and the research revealed it was really better in Midtown. It was April 2nd, 1979. There were several chef masters from China who had fled to New York City, and that was part of what made the Chinese restaurant scene so vital and exciting. So you had masters like Chef Liu and Uncle Tai. Oh, that was just a great moment. And we, in a lot of ways, Craig Claiborne, who had been the most important critic at the New York Times, who was my competitor when I became a critic at New York Magazine. I was overwhelmed with the idea that that's who my competition was. Craig loved spicy food, and he taught Americans how to eat very spicy food to the point where salsa sold greater amounts than ketchup.
Huh. And that
we owe our taste for chilies, I think, a lot to Craig giving us the courage to try them.
Well, so much can be directly tied to the development of the American cuisine and the development of New York cuisine, of which you are an incredible part and remain an incredible part. I think the look back through history from an anthropological view at your website is tremendous. And, Gail, it was a pleasure to have you on the show, as always.
Oh, great to talk to you.
You can find out more about Gail Green on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll link you up to all the fabulous things she's doing today. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Gail Green, amazing. Did you read the review she mentioned, Frank Rooney's review of Table 8?
I read it this morning, and I thought, ouchie.
You know, whenever you see a satisfactory review, which is no stars, by the way, but at least it's not a poor.
Right, it's not a negative one star, it's
right.
Zero
poor
stars.
Poor is negative one star is what you can consider that. You don't see a lot of those. But, it's funny because celebrity brings with it certain, like most restaurants that are just don't get reviewed.
Right.
Why it was reviewed was because the chef, Govind Armstrong, was on Top Chef, and he had Table 8 in L.A., but the funny thing is, if you look at this guy's career, Table 8 in L.A. became a hamburger joint, and Table 8 in Miami closed, and now he's got Table 8 in New York. What, third time's the charm? You figure I didn't make it in Miami, so New York is a much more forgiving market? Anyway, Rooney rips it apart, and he says the food, what did he say? Oh, here's one.
Here's what I'm going to say. I've never eaten there. I've never eaten his food. I have no opinion whatsoever. But reading this review doesn't make me want to go and try his food.
But I think, one of the unfortunate things, though, is look at one of the things that said in the first column of the review. The New York debut of Govind Armstrong, one of those supremely telegenic chefs whose celebrity seems to outpace his accomplishments. You know, when you get that celebrity chef status, you set yourself up to be reviewed. You set a higher bar for yourself, you know. And I think that he really got slammed and... I mean, he talks about the layout of the restaurant. His table kept getting banged with a chair. The pasta was uneven. The filet was stringy.
Well, and one of the things that's in this review that Gail was talking about that's just happened, and it's happened in a lot of restaurants, is the restaurant becomes so loud that you can't talk at the table without yelling at each other or yelling to each other.
Totally not into that.
And, maybe in that type of restaurant you need to text each other.
One of the things that... Bernie talks about in the review that I think is funny is the neighbors evidently are fairly unhappy with this hotel that it's in. It's a brand new hotel. It's a very modern thing in the East Village. It sort of doesn't fit in with the rest of the neighborhood, and it's causing, the neighbors, a lot of noise,
The neighbors are kind of flying their own flag, as it were.
What the neighbors have done is they're, in order to make it seem less cool and to fly in the face of his cool, what they're doing is they're hanging their dirty briefs and the like from clotheslines that are readily visible from the restaurant so that there's dirty underwear hanging out around the restaurant. You think you're so cool. I bet you, but I'll tell you what, I bet you nobody notices. It's New York City.
As far as the protest of a restaurant, like being in the neighborhood and you're too loud and you're not doing things the way you're supposed to, hanging your dirty underwear out the window, I don't know. I kind of find it amusing.
Especially if it's a restaurant that was trying to be self-consciously cool, because how cool can you be when somebody else's boxers are fluttering over your head? And you know what? I'm going to say, I think this is a little bit of a hyperbole. I'm going to assume, knowing the people in the East Village, that it's probably their clean boxers and the like that are just out there to dry. Let's just hope. I think otherwise it'd go too far. Well, anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascoe.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com.